Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I remember when Rock was young. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
So, memory. I wanted to talk about memory today. Specifically, I wanted to talk about memory because it's one of my favorite things that pops up in science fiction, the idea of messing with memory.
I thought you were going to say it's one of my favorite things that pops up in my brain.
It can be. I don't know. Do you guys ever have that issue where you are feeling really relaxed and content and you're feeling like things are really going well, and then your brain says, oh, this can't happen, and so pulls up a terrible memory of something you did where you made a complete jackass of yourself and then replays it?
Yeah. Brains are jerks.
Yeah, wouldn't it be awesome to get rid of that memory so that we would no longer have that, and when we're happy and content, we can just bask in the moment?
Oh, absolutely. And according to science fiction, this is easy peasy.
Yeah,
I mean, this
it happens
is gonna,
all the time.
Right, continually.
Wait, are we talking about removing bad memories or adding good memories?
Either one. Yeah.
Either one. Okay. So you have like Inception.
Sure.
Sure.
That's that's more like than the dream world, but that's related to memory. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
That can definitely involve.
Oh, yeah. You're right. That is dreams.
Yeah.
I was getting them mixed up there.
But Total Recall.
Total Recall. Now that's a classic film. And we're talking about
The Schwarzenegger
the
version.
Original.
The Verhoeven one.
The amazing, amazing science fiction film.
I did not see the more recent one, but it looked slick and boring.
I saw the original one in the theater. I remember all the stories coming out about how the body count in that movie was astronomically high.
Yeah.
It was large.
It's incredibly violent.
Yeah. And it, of course, has one of the best tour de force performances by Mr. Schwarzenegger.
You mean on the commentary track where he describes everything that's happening on the screen as it happens?
That also, I was thinking specifically in the context of the film itself, but it does, in fact, spill over into the meta world around the film. Thank you, Joe. That was a direct quote. We want to make sure we reference that.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, Total Recall, of course, the premise of the movie is that you have a character who he's kind of like going on a vacation, but in this case, he's having a vacation implanted in his mind.
Yeah, the service they sell is they say, well, you know, it's cheaper than going on an actual vacation. We'll just give you memories that make you feel like you had a vacation.
And in this case, the memories were supposed to make him feel as if he were some sort of super spy who had traveled to Mars and been part of this major operation where it was, you know, he was kind of the difference between life and death for the planet. But within the context of the film, it also opens up the possibility that he really is, in fact, this super spy. And he just believes he's a normal guy because those memories have been implanted.
Fake.
Yeah. So either way, whether you go with the story that he's a normal guy but believes he's a spy and everything else is playing out in his mind, or he really is a spy, but he thought he was a normal dude because his memories had been supplanted by these fake ones. We're talking about messing with memory. And this is not the only time we see this pop up in science fiction.
Certainly not. There was also Strange Days.
Strange Days, yeah.
Which is one of my favorite, incredibly disturbing films.
I remember seeing that movie and being very interested in the idea of, and this is just sort of a thing that is sort of a MacGuffin in that particular movie, but they have the superconducting quantum interference device, or SQID, and this allows you to record memories. So a person who has one of these devices can record memories that they are experiencing and then can essentially export those memories. I mean, they hold on to them themselves, too. It's more like a copy.
Sure.
They can export a copy of those memories to someone else who can then experience those memories. In the context of the movie, it all ends up involving a robbery gone wrong, a bank heist gone wrong, and then nefarious things unfold because of it. But there's another one where we're talking about letting someone experience a memory that they themselves have not actually formed personally based on their own experience.
There is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I remember I went and saw this in the theater
knowing
nothing about it.
Yeah.
Like I hadn't even seen a trailer,
it
was a great experience because I didn't know what was going to happen in the movie. I didn't have a clue. And when the plot developed, spoiler alert, that it does eventually turn into a situation where there's a service in the movie that sells you the option of erasing memories, such as like the memory of an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend.
Right. Someone who you're no longer with and you just want to wipe that from your brain entirely.
Because it's just too painful.
Right.
Yeah. Like even the good memories, you want to get rid of them because now that you no longer have that relationship, it's painful to even recollect. So that becomes the central premise of that film. And I mean, or at least that's the kind of the instigator for things that happen within the movie.
Yeah, I'd say the central premise really is more of a question of, you know, should we do this? Do we really want to forget the things that we think we want to forget, and wouldn't we miss those memories if once we get to that situation? Wouldn't we want them
right
back?
And then, of course, another central film in the concept of memory manipulation.
Every bit as deep and loving as Eternal Sunshine.
Yeah, Men in Black. Yeah, with the neuralizer, the little flashbang. Yeah, the little flashy device makes you forget the last, you know, whatever, the last, however convenient it is to the plot, many minutes that have just passed, so that the Men in Black can convince everyone that it was just, you know, swamp gas or an electrical disturbance rather than aliens running amok.
Yeah, and actually, lest you forget, the best version of this plot device in films is in the Golan Globus film Superman 4. Superman.
How is it possible that no matter what the topic is, you somehow find a way of wrapping this back to Superman 4, Quest for Peace?
Well, you know, you've got to find peace somehow.
Not through this podcast.
Somebody's got to do it. It's not going to be the president. It's not going to be the Russians.
Right.
Yeah, it's got to be Superman.
Produce your explanation and pray make it improbable.
Well, if you recall from the film, there's a scene where Superman basically reveals his identity to Lois Lane and then he wipes her memory.
Because that's not creepy at all, you guys.
It seems abusive.
That also happens in Superman 2. Magic kiss.
Yeah, okay. Okay. I totally forgot about that. Well, I've seen 4 more recently than 2.
There's so much wrong in what you just said. Superman 4, by the way, one of the memories I would love to erase.
Yeah, that would be great. But then how would you remember the bad guy with his press-on nails?
I wouldn't, and it would make me a happier person.
Okay.
But
we're getting off track.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Have we been on track yet?
No, I think
we've just talked about how often people bring up the topic of, I'd really love to create fake memories or get rid of real memories.
Or just strengthen memories I have because I know that there are conditions, there's just the process of aging where people have trouble remembering stuff, and I would like to hold on to those memories for as long as possible.
Sure.
Yeah, so I guess the question within the realm of this podcast is it possible we could actually do that technologically?
So, to answer that question, first we have to explore what exactly is a memory. Now, on one level, a memory is a recollection of some stimuli that you encountered in the past. And that sounds vague, but it's because memory is a really big topic, right?
Mm-hmm. And we still don't know exactly how it works all the time. The brain is a little bit mysterious, but there is a physical process that we have more or less identified
of what's
going on when we form and recall memories.
Yeah. So I'd say the brain is more than a little bit mysterious with memory. I mean,
yeah,
that was really...
A pretty,
yeah, she's being generous.
Yeah.
So we have several regions of our brains, right?
Yeah.
It's not just one big mass of gray matter with no differentiation between one part and the next. There is one region called the hippocampus, which is associated with forming long-term memories.
It's where hippopotamuses go to college.
That's, you know, actually, yes, the hippocampus.
Yeah.
Be a big hippo on campus.
Right.
I don't know that you're allowed to talk anymore. So this is part of the forebrain, and it's located inside the medial temporal lobe. And memories are made up of neurons that communicate with each other through synapses. Now, synapses are those gaps between one neuron and other neurons.
And, of course, neurons are the basic nerve cells in the brain.
Exactly.
Right.
So in the brain, we have around between, you know, 80 billion and 100 billion neurons. A single neuron can have synapses that allow it to communicate with thousands of other neurons. You know, it's not just it can communicate.
It's not a one-to-one thing.
Yeah,
right.
Or even a one-to-a-dozen thing. We're talking about the potential to communicate with hundreds or thousands of other cells. Again, depending upon the complexity of the brain we're looking at. Now, with human brains, it's pretty darn complex.
So how do neurons make memories? Do they make new neurons, or do they...
They form pathways of communication within the hippocampus.
Okay.
So kind of imagine that, this is oversimplifying, and again, this is based upon our current understanding of memory.
Right.
Keeping in mind that we don't have
a lot more.
Yeah, we don't have a complete picture, but they form a pathway when you encounter a set of stimuli that you need to remember something. Let's say it's short-term memory. They end up communicating with one another through electrochemical means. That's the way neurons communicate. And in short-term memory, they just do a really quick and dirty, short electrochemical response that can be repeated a couple of times as necessary for you to remember something while it's happening at the time. So, you know, short-term memory, where you're able to remember something for a couple of minutes, and then if you don't think about it, if you don't really try to commit it to memory, it's gone. That's what we're talking about here. If you want to try and convert something into a long-term memory where you're trying to really remember something, trying to get a concept down, like you're studying for a test and you're taking, you know, you're reading this one passage, then resting for a while, and then reading the passage again and making sure you understand it. This is where that same communication pathway gets repeated, but now it's repeated with different proteins to kind of make it a more, I hesitate to use the word permanent, but a more stable pathway. All right. So you've got these neurons that are creating this same sort of pathway. Whenever you remember that thing that you've committed to memory, this pathway reforms mostly because through the actual process of remembering, it turns out that we have to forge this pathway over and over again. Whenever we're filing the memory away, we're essentially recreating the memory that was created the first time. This is something that came out of studies that started in the 1960s, really, and then, it didn't get widespread acceptance within the brain research field until later. The common thought was that once you created a long-term memory, you ended up consolidating it. That's what they called it, was consolidation, and that your memory was pretty much set. Like, you had put it into long-term memory, you're good to go. As it turns out, that's not exactly what happens. You have this reconsolidation that happens where every time you are filing that memory away again so that you can recall it later, you are essentially re-encoding that memory. And that means that you could alter the memory through the re-encoding process. So little details could change. This might be why if you hear someone tell the same story and you've known this person forever, you think, that's not the way that story goes. They totally left out this other part, or I don't ever remember hearing this thing they said this other time.
It might not be because they are trying to mislead you on purpose, but rather because they literally remember it differently.
Exactly. The memory itself is different.
Because the process of recalling a memory changes that memory.
So as a related tangent, this should tell you that if the nature of memory is such that we re-encode our memories every time we file them away, that tells you that relying upon memory for important stuff is not always a great idea.
And should perhaps not be relied upon as heavily as it is in, say, like court cases or
That's
other
a great example.
Life-changing.
Yeah. So in a court case, you know, we often see that people put more importance on witness testimony than they do on other types of evidence.
Physical evidence.
Yeah, also. This is obviously a generalization. Mm-hmm. It's not the case in every court case, but it's something that we see as a trend where people put the human element ends up having a greater impact on us than either, things that we just have to conceptualize or just random pieces of information. The human element often seems to have a greater impact on us, which is unfortunate because memory is not infallible. It doesn't mean that it's completely unreliable either, but it does mean that just by the very physical nature of the way memories are formed, we cannot be completely certain that what we remember is exactly what has happened. It's a little worrisome or freeing, depending upon your point of view. I, at this point, wipe my hands of all responsibility. Like, Jonathan, you did this terrible thing. I have no memory of that, and I can be honest. Or at least that's not the way I remember it.
But even outside of this accidental changing of memories that happens, there has been a little bit of research, right, into how we can purposefully alter memories?
Absolutely. And a lot of this comes from some studies that, again, started in the 1960s, experiments that looked at the hippocampus and the way that memories are formed. One of the things that we looked at was the fact that if you stimulate neurons in the hippocampus, you can make them better at communicating with each other. You can boost their ability to communicate, which means that you could help memories form more quickly, or you could reinforce a memory, reinforcing that pathway. They used this electrical stimulation, and they called the process long-term potentiation, also known as LTP, which is pretty much how I'm going to say it from here on out, because I'll trip over.
Potentiation?
Yeah, potentiation. I trip over it pretty frequently. So long-term potentiation was suspected by some to play a really important role in encoding memories, but it wasn't necessarily, again, accepted as a widespread concept for a while. There were brain researchers who said, well, it's obviously important, but I don't know that it's the primary cause. And more importantly, we don't have enough direct evidence, right? Because that's how science works. We can create a hypothesis, but until we test that hypothesis repeatedly and get the same result, we can't really draw a firm conclusion.
Sure.
That's the difference between hypothesis and theory. And even theories can change, but they are more of a kind of consolidated body of information that we understand about some aspect of the universe.
And they're also different from the colloquial use of the word theory, in which you can say, well, I've got a theory that it's a demon.
So a singing demon? No, something's not right there.
Right. Exactly.
All right.
Anyway.
Yeah, sorry.
What? Back to mice.
Any sort of Buffy quote, and I'm going to jump all over it.
Or rats, at any rate.
Rats,
yeah.
So rats and mice. Their experiments have been done with both, with LTP and forming of memories, as well as erasing memories, but I'll get to that in a second. So how can you tell if a mouse or a rat is remembering something? You can't really sit down with a mouse or a rat and say, hey, do you remember that one wheel of cheese? Man, that was awesome. It doesn't really work. So one of the very common ways, here's where we get into the part of the podcast that could very much upset some people, because we're talking about experimenting upon animals in the name of science. This is one of the ways is conditioning them to fear a certain stimulus by following up that stimulus with a little electric zap. So not enough to really harm them.
To damage them. But
yeah, enough for it to be a pain stimulus. So you're usually talking about like a certain pitch of sound, and then you follow that up with a zap. Now, rats catch on to this really quickly. From what I understand, you usually only have to do it once.
Mm-hmm.
And then they learn to associate the sound with getting zapped. And if you play the sound again, they freeze in anticipation of the oncoming zap. So they build that memory very quickly. But in order to try and test this LTP idea, what scientists would do is back in the 1960s, they started doing this, and then they continued that into the 80s. They would establish something like the sound and the zap, and then they would introduce some form of inhibitor that would inhibit LTP from taking place. It would either be a drug, or sometimes they would introduce a gene that would inhibit LTP, and then they would observe the rats. And they saw that the rats would not be able to form a memory connecting the sound to getting zapped, or they would just essentially forget. Like you could play the sound and they wouldn't freeze. They didn't associate it anymore. They had forgotten that association. And that was leaning more toward the evidence that LTP has this role in encoding memories, but still wasn't exactly conclusive. It was one of those things where it says, all right, well, this is promising. Let's continue research and seeing what else we can find. So that was the basis for that early LTP research. We'll get back to that in just a minute.
Right. What might have something to do with this is something called dendritic spines. And there's one study in particular that came out of NYU that was about sleep and how sleep strengthens memory that has a lot to do with this. Okay. So dendritic spines are these little protrusions between neurons, and they facilitate the transfer of signals across synapses, right? They grow, in mice at least, in the first few hours after the mice have learned a new skill.
So this is something that actually develops throughout the lifetime of the mouse as the mouse learns, you know, differential equations and,
right,
you know, how to do a Rodney Dangerfield impression, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
And they strengthen that memory of that skill. And these researchers found that these structures grow more during sleep. They trained two sets of mice at a task and then let one set sleep for 7 hours and kept the others awake for 7 hours. The sleep-deprived mice had less dendritic spine growth. Furthermore, they tracked which brain cells activated during the learning process, and those same brain cells reactivated while the mice were asleep, specifically while they were in deep sleep, which is a slow wave sleep, it's sometimes called, which is when the brain waves slow down and dreaming and or rapid eye movement stops. This is really interesting for many reasons. This is some of the kind of current research that's being done into exactly why this kind of long-term memory formation happens. In a separate study that was out of the Scripps Research Institute, scientists did some of that inhibition thing that you were talking about earlier. They inhibited the growth of dendritic spines a few days after training mice to associate methamphetamines with a few different sight, touch, and scent clues. Later on, the mice lost all interest in those drug-associated cues while still maintaining longer-held food reward memories. So they're hoping that this could lead to ways of selectively removing harmful memories like related to addiction or to PTSD or something like that while still maintaining other
memories. Yeah. So in other words, you're not doing a full system wipe. You're wiping ones that are causing possible distress or problems in a person's life. Obviously, right now we're talking about rodents, not people.
Yes.
And we'll touch on that again in just a moment, because and that's very important to remember. Rats' brains and human brains, in most cases,
they're similar.
Yeah.
But we've got some different stuff going on.
For most human beings, it's true. There may be exceptions. At any rate, moving on. So that's a great point, and we'll reiterate that when we get to a little bit further along in our podcast. We wanted to talk about another concept that's going to fold into this, optogenetics.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting. So optogenetics is a fairly new tool in neuroscience, and it's when you genetically engineer cells, which in this case would be neurons, brain cells, to become light sensitive, so you can either activate them or inhibit their activity with light waves, making it much easier to study and manipulate these cells.
Yeah, so, it's a really simple on and off switch as opposed to the complex neurochemicals and electrical signals that normally happen in a brain.
Exactly. So for one example, you can make neurons light sensitive by adding proteins called, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, channel rhodopsins.
Sounds good to me.
Seems legit.
Abbreviated the two different kinds of them, CHR1 and CHR2. And you'll see these pop up sometimes in studies of optogenetics. These proteins occur naturally in algae, a certain type of algae that use light-sensitive spots to help steer themselves towards sunlight in water. They've got these flagella, and they operate moving toward the light when the light strikes this spot. But once animal neurons are upgraded with, for example, CHR2, blue light triggers action potentials in those neurons. So in other words, you can target specific cells and turn them on whenever you want. And this is a really revolutionary research tool, since it gives researchers unprecedented control and precision in studying how different cells in the brain work. You can target really, really, really specific processes and single those out to see what they do.
Yeah. It's a little weird too, because it's almost like, hey y'all, watch what happens when I push this button.
Yeah, exactly.
Except instead of button, you're talking about regions of an animal's brain.
Yeah.
So on a similar test, the University of California, San Diego had a research team that was looking into using optogenetics to further study the relationship between LTP and encoding memories. And in this case, they got one of those genes that produces a light-sensitive protein. They put that into a virus. They then injected the virus into rat brains, which infected the neurons and transmitted this gene to the neurons. So the neurons would end up having this light-sensitive protein in them as well. So by, again, exposing the neurons to light in the form of a fiber optic cable that was surgically implanted in the rat's brain, they could stimulate those neurons and thus stimulate LTP. Or they could use a different set of pulses of light that would inhibit LTP. In fact, it would stimulate what's called long-term depression, or LTD. It's kind of like the opposite of LTP. LTD allows you to sort of wipe away some of those pathways that would represent a memory. And what they ended up doing was they targeted the pathway in the rats' brains that connected the hearing processing center of the rat's brain with the part of the rat's brain that deals with fear. And the reason for this was that they would stimulate the neurons in the rat's brain so it would simulate the rat hearing a sound. They didn't play a sound.
Mm-hmm.
They just shined a light on that part of the rat's brain so the rat would
remembered
react.
Remembered a sound.
Exactly. It had heard a sound. And they followed that up, of course, with the requisite mild electric shock, meaning that when they would do that again, shining the light on the rat's brains, the rats would freeze, just as if they had heard the sound. But they're reacting to a totally new type of stimulus. There's no actual physical sound being played. So that was already kind of a breakthrough. Now, then they would use these pulses of light to induce LTD and effectively erase that association with the simulated sound and the electric shock. So when they would, quote-unquote, play the simulated sound again, the rats wouldn't react because they had forgotten.
Yeah.
They no longer remembered that meant they were about to get zapped again. So this study is being looked at as yet another kind of strong evidence for the relationship between LTP and encoding memory. Not saying, again, that there aren't other molecular elements at play when you get to encoding memory, but that LTP does play a very important role. And that's really why this research was covered so extensively, although I think a lot of the coverage was more about, hey, we can make rats remember and forget stuff, which is true. They actually did do it over and over. Essentially, one article I read said they were playing yo-yo with the rats' memories.
No.
So, yeah, you remember, you forget, you remember, you forget.
It's like how Superman treats Lois Lane.
Yeah.
Aww.
Yeah. They were giving
only in those movies.
Yeah. They were giving the rats the kiss of forgetfulness and then reminding them, hey, you know what that sound means, right?
I'm Superman.
Yeah. Smooch. I'm Superman again. Smooch. Like, the real problem was that Lois Lane kept forgetting other things. Like, there went the piano lessons. Yeah. All right. Well, moving on to other things. Things to remember. Lauren mentioned the potential of using the basic building blocks we're learning today in future therapies. And that is promising. It is something that would happen. If it does happen, it's going to happen years or decades in the future, because memory is very complex. And again, rat brains and human brains aren't identical. And also, the methods that we're talking about right now tend to be fairly invasive or require some pretty extreme measures.
Yeah, it seems like you're either talking about genetic engineering, so you need to design this baby to be like this from the time it's a kid, or like introducing a virus to an adult.
Not to mention an optical fiber implanted in their brain, which would theoretically be connected to something that could produce the light necessary to shine on the neurons. It's not something that is, you know, it's not a non-invasive procedure in that case.
Right, right. Even some of the studies that I was talking about, you would be discussing, inducing a lack of protein growth in the brain after memories had been formed so that they could not form these dendritic spines.
And this is dangerous stuff is what
we're
saying.
So, you don't want to play around with it in a person.
That being said, it's possible that the stuff we're learning today will lead eventually to some very useful therapies, not just in helping treat people who have post-traumatic stress disorder or an addiction, and they want to break, you know, they want to break those neural pathways that are associated with forming a habit,
mm-hmm.
which could, in theory, be really, really useful. But also for things like strengthening memories, for people who have a neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's, where they might have trouble, or someone who suffered a stroke even. So people who might have trouble getting access to those. This kind of information could help us, perhaps, in the future, rebuild these connections that were once thought to be completely lost, so people can actually regain memories that they didn't even know they had. I mean, that's the real trick about memory, right? You can't remember what you've already forgotten.
You can't. No. Although, you know, outside of degenerative brain disorders like that, there is a place for losing memories. It's actually an important part of the brain process.
I argue this all the time with my wife, and she does not believe me.
well, okay, so
Do you still remember Superman 4? We were talking about it earlier.
Unfortunately, that one has stayed with me.
And every time I bring it up, I'm strengthening that connection.
Well, there's another connection that's happening right now that's associated with you, Joe. I think you may want to tread lightly before you continue down this path.
I'm talking about some specific research that was done. It was done at the University of British Columbia that indicates that when connections between neurons are too strong, they call it sticky. That means that new things are difficult to learn, that it becomes more difficult for us to modulate our behavior and adapt to changes, stuff like that.
That's really interesting.
I also think that, you know, we didn't really cover this in our notes, but it kind of leads into the idea of facilitating education. You know, the fact that memory and learning are very closely connected. Things like, can you imagine being able to use sort of these techniques to strengthen our brain when learning something like a new language?
Mm-hmm.
And something that is something that is easier for younger people to do than it is for old fogies like me, who, it's not that I can't learn a new language, it's just that it's going to take me more effort to do something that a younger person will pick up much more quickly. I could see this kind of research eventually leading to techniques that would allow us to facilitate learning in different stages of our life so that it's one of those, you know, we can regain that plasticity that we have when we're younger and really and apply that to whatever it is we're interested in when we're older. Again, this is stuff that we're talking about years and years and decades into the future, because there's so much about the brain we don't understand and that we don't even know we don't know, that it's going to take some time before we can even address this in a remotely experimental way, much less in a widespread, like, you know, you go to the learning store and get yourself some French lessons.
Huh, right.
So if you guys out there who have been listening to this podcast think, hey, I always wanted to ask this one question, but I keep forgetting to do it, now's the time to remember. And if you do remember what it was that you wanted to ask, but you don't remember how to contact us, I'll remind you. Twitter, Facebook, Google+, all great avenues to explore. Use the handle FWThinking to find us. And we look forward to hearing from you, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.